Good afternoon. Thanks so much for hanging in there with us. It's great to see a few folks here on a nice day toward the end of the day. I just wanted to, actually, thank you. I wanted to first acknowledge my co-authors on this project. There's a paper and press on this, so if you want more detail, I can give you more information on that later. But Martha Shumway, Kelly Knight, Jennifer Cohen, David Guzman, and Sherry Weiser were my able and enthusiastic co-authors on this study. So I have no relationships to disclose for this study. So I'm going to start off by briefly touching on crack cocaine. As you're going to see in a minute, crack cocaine is hands down the most commonly used drug among homeless women in San Francisco, and it's having really devastating health consequences. So the use of the coca leaf as an intoxicant has been around for 3,000 years, while the use of cocaine in its crystallized form, or crack cocaine, really became more popular in the 1970s during the cocaine epidemic and spread into the 1980s. The rock form of cocaine, or crack cocaine, is sold in smaller quantities, making it cheap, it's accessible to more people, it's highly addictive, and it's profitable for people to sell. The devastating health consequences of crack were widely studied in the 80s, and they were widely publicized in the 80s, and that was 30 years ago. 30 years later, the use of crack cocaine is relatively lower, especially when it's considered relative to other illicit substances and prescription drugs. In addition, recent reports have shown downward trends in crack cocaine use, particularly in some populations of interest like high school students. So from a public health perspective, this is really good news. However, cocaine and crack cocaine still are major problems in some populations. In particular, people living in low-income and high-poverty areas, people experiencing homelessness and housing instability, those leaving correctional settings, and people seeking emergency room treatment. In sum, it's still a problem in many impoverished urban areas. In addition, there are gender differences in addiction. We know from a variety of studies that compared to men, women have higher rates of dependence, more severe forms of addiction, and lower rates of treatment. In addition, my colleagues and I have found that the health consequences of using cocaine and crack cocaine are extreme. A couple years ago, we reported a 3% annual mortality rate among homeless and unstably housed women in San Francisco. These were ladies in their 40s. Half of them were HIV positive, and there was a lot of comorbid conditions, but these ladies were not dying of HIV or comorbidities. Acute intoxication where cocaine was on board was the most common cause of death at autopsy reported on death certificates. Now, 3% annual mortality rate may sound pretty high, and it is. If 3% of the general population's women in their 40s were dying, we would probably have a little bit of an outcry. But these are homeless women, and this is the state of things. When you consider it relative to the prevalence of use, though, it's actually probably what you would expect. When we look at the proportion of homeless and unstably housed women who are diagnosed with a substance disorder, it's 83% from our studies. And this is compared to 1% of the general population. And when you look at what drugs people are using, among people who have a drug disorder over the past year, 70% of them are using cocaine and crack cocaine. So it is hands down the most common drug used. And just to be clear, there is a fair amount of polysubstance use in this cohort, but cocaine and crack cocaine are very much the most commonly used drugs. So my colleagues and I, knowing that 70% of these ladies have a substance use disorder, including cocaine, in the last year, and knowing that cocaine use is the most, acute intoxication where cocaine is on board is the most common cause of death, we were interested in knowing what's going on with the ladies who aren't using. What's the risk of using if you don't happen to be using right now? So we asked this question in an existing cohort. The cohort is called the Shelter Health and Drug Outcomes Among Women cohort, or the Shadow cohort. Shadow recruited biological women from all San Francisco homeless shelters that housed women, a probability sample of low-income single-room occupancy hotels selected with probability proportionate to the number of women housed, and all free meal programs serving over 100 meals a day. Our study staff went out to these venues, screened ladies at these venues, and people who had a history of housing instability were invited to participate in a cohort study in which they would come to a community-based field site and every 6 months do interviews and blood draws. We oversampled for HIV-positive ladies on additional recruitment days, and we had less than a 10% refusal rate for study participation. So the sample population for the parent study, for the Shadow study, reflected San Francisco's larger population of homeless and unstably housed biological women. And for this study, because we were interested in risk of starting to use stimulants, we restricted that population to people who did not report using stimulants at baseline. So that is people who did not report crack cocaine, powder cocaine, amphetamines, and methamphetamines. Our outcome was a self-report of using any stimulants in the 6 months following baseline after reporting no stimulant use. We included first use, we included use after brief abstinence, and we included use after very long periods of abstinence. Exposures that we chose have been previously linked to poor health and addiction in impoverished populations. They included socioeconomic factors like age and race, unmet subsistence needs, including food, clothing, shelter, and hygiene needs, social isolation, drug and alcohol use, mental illness as measured by the diagnostic interview survey, violence, and drug treatment. So in this analysis, we had 260 biological women included. The median age was 47 years. At baseline, almost 20% were employed. Just over half were married or partnered. And 70% of the population were women of color. In the last 6 months alone, almost a third slept on the street or in an abandoned car or building. Almost half reported at least one unmet subsistence need. And 53% used stimulants in the last 6 months. And that is compared to a previous slide I showed where 70% of the population had used substances over an entire year. This was just the last 6 months. At baseline, when we compared people who used stimulants to people who didn't, a higher proportion of stimulant users were homeless, depressed, had manic episodes, experienced physical or sexual violence in the last 6 months, used unprescribed opioid analgesics, reported at-risk alcohol use, or were participating in inpatient or outpatient substance use treatment. So this is baseline cross-sectional data. We don't know from these data which came first. Was it the stimulant use or were it these factors? So this is leading me into our risk analysis. When we restricted to only people who did not report stimulant use at baseline, we were left with 118 women, and unadjusted analysis indicated that the strongest predictors of stimulant use were recent sexual violence, heroin use, unprescribed opioid analgesics, and being in drug treatment. When we conducted analyses based on fit of the model, our most parsimonious model included sleeping in a shelter or public place, experiencing sexual violence, and using unprescribed opioid analgesics. Now, these results have a few limitations. First, drug use was self-reported. We did use what's called audio computer-assisted self-interviewing techniques so that our participants could report to a computer rather than having to admit to another human being that they use drugs, which in other studies has shown to increase reporting of drug use. And we did use this, but there's still possibly more drug use that wasn't reported. However, I will say that this would have biased our results toward the null, meaning that risks are at least as strong as those reported here. In addition, because of our small sample size, we could not refine drug treatment any more than we did. So we know from prior studies that the type of treatment, the quality of treatment, consistency and duration of treatment all influence future use, and we could not get to that level of detail. And there were not many people in drug treatment to begin with. And we also did not distinguish between first use and continued use. But to us, that gave us more of a real-world perspective in terms of if you're a healthcare provider or a social service provider and a homeless lady comes to you, what's the population-level risk of her starting to use? So with these results and limitations in mind, my colleagues and I came to several conclusions. First, over half of homeless and unstably housed women use stimulants. And among those who don't, a relatively high proportion are at risk for using in a very short time period. Risks that have been identified by other studies, such as age and race, did not predict stimulant use in this population. Adjusting for polysubstance use, we found that sexual violence and homelessness predicted stimulant use, and that drug treatment did not confound these effects. Thus, increasing access to safe and permanent housing and decreasing sexual violence is critical to reducing stimulant use among impoverished women. Thanks so much for your attention. I just wanted to acknowledge our study participants who continue to come back to us and trust us with their stories and how much we value and honor that. Also our study team, there's a lot of people who it takes to do a study like this, as I'm sure you all well know, and the National Institute of Drug Abuse for funding our work. Thanks so much.